Hello and welcome to episode 180 of the Bronx Beat podcast of Baseball Prospectus. My name is EJ Fagan, and today I'm not joined by any of our normal co-hosts. I'm joined by, of Baseball Prospectus, Jarrett Seidler, who just recently wrote the Top 10 Yankee Prospects. So, Jarrett, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, this is fun. You know, we were talking about how to cover prospects this year and realized that none of us knew anything about kind of the current crop of Yankee prospects, because until about a year ago, they were all in rookie ball. So we thought, you know, we'd have Jared on to talk a little bit about the system, to kind of give us the objective point of view. Jared, you're not a Yankee fan?
No, I'm a Mets fan.
Okay, so maybe even a little more cynical.
I see a lot of Yankees baseball because I'm pretty or Yankees farm system baseball because I'm pretty close to Trenton and Staten Island. So,
Stadium is wonderful. I love that stadium.
It's nice. It's real nice. It's also conveniently located for me, not the residents of Trenton, but it's, you know, basically right at the end of the 29 tunnel, so just kind of hop on. It's also, like, really convenient if you, like, live in anywhere in New Jersey or if you, like, have a car from New York City. Like, you just hop right on the turnpike, get off at 7A, and it's, like, 6 miles, and you basically just drive right in. So
yeah, just don't go when it's cold outside and the wind's coming off the river.
Yeah, it gets some of those like early April games are just freaking brutal there.
So I just like to ask you a little bit about the Yankee farm system kind of as a whole. So like this time last year, the Yankees had not graduated yet Gleyber Torres. They still had like, you know, a couple of other guys like Tyler Wade still in the system. But the line on the Yankee farm system at the time was that it was deeper than any farm system anyone's ever seen. Is that still the case? Is this still a top, I don't know, 10 farm system-ish? I don't know if you guys have done your rankings yet in baseball. And is that depth real or imaginary?
The rankings are done. I don't think they've been released yet. I don't remember offhand if they were in the top 10 or just out of it, but they were, like, right on the borderline. I still like the system a lot. It's not as deep as, like, the Rays or the Padres. I'm not really sure it ever was that deep. But, you know, this is it's lacking the top names, but it's not lacking the top names because they didn't have them. It's lacking the top names because they graduated Gleyber Torres and Miguel Andujar last year. And because Clint Frazier's in like that weird purgatory where he's not eligible for lists, but is functionally still a prospect, and Tyler Wade's kind of in that group too. But this is like this, and we'll talk about this a little more in depth. But this is a very deep system. And it's an extremely Yankee system. It's like all low cost starting pitching prospects and athletic up the middle players. It's like all of them. That literally describes everybody that we put in the top 15 and then also three of the four guys we put in, like, the next group. So it literally describes all of the top 18 prospects in the system.
So what is the system good at? You describe some types of players, but, like, what's going to emerge out of the system in 3 or 4 years that will be a strength for the Yankee roster?
A lot of pitching. And that's – you've already seen that at the major league level, where you have guys like Jonathan Holder and one or two of these guys, it's hard to say which one or two, but one or two of these guys is going to do the Luis Severino and take a big step forward and end up being a frontline starter because they just have so many of them. Like, I don't know whether it's going to be the Weisiga or Roansy Contreras or Debbie Garcia or Clark Schmidt or one of the Luises. But if you have that many guys with that type of, like, you know, 90th percentile upside, it's you know, you're increasing your lottery balls there. And they've picked all these guys up out of, like, really weird places. There's a lot of low-budget international signings. You know, the Weisiga was a minor league free agent that they pulled out of an international tournament in Nicaragua. They're extremely good at mining the bottom levels of other teams' farms for prospects that the other team doesn't value that turn out to be really good.
So is the best player in the trade that got the Yankees Caleb Smith and Garrett Cooper actually the throw-in from the Marlins, Michael King?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a nice. And he's not going to be a superstar impact player. He's got a chance to be like a third or fourth starter. We think it's probably a little more likely that he's kind of like a setup arm. But to pull that out of the throw-in on a trade that like five people paid attention to when it was made and was one of those deals that they largely made for 40-man clearance, which was also the Jake Cave for Louis Gill trade. Like, they just keep doing it over and over again. There's two teams in particular that when they call you on your, like, short season A pitcher, you should just hang up the phone, and it's the Yankees and the Astros, because they've done it time and time again, and teams still trade with them because nobody ever learns anything.
Do you have any idea why? Like, what magic the Yankees are bringing to this, or is that pretty much a closely held secret?
I think they know their organizational strengths very well. They know what they do well in player development, and they got an awful lot of really good scouts. They just do. Like, you see the Yank. You know, when you're out, you know, watching games, you see the Yankees everywhere. They always have, you know, scouts that know what they're talking about, or always on the lookout for these guys. They scout, like, the complex leagues very heavily, which a lot of teams don't because it's that added expense. But if you pull, you know, one Luis Gill out of the Twins Dominican complex, you know, you've picked up millions and millions of dollars in, quote, surplus value.
And so it seems like the Yankees are, they're being the Yankees, the evil empire in the infrastructure, but not in the players. They're picking these guys up for nothing. In fact, the Yankees had, I think it was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, this big July 2nd spending spree where they went way over the caps and essentially got banned from spending a lot of money in subsequent years, in the next 3 years, on international free agents. And I don't see any of those guys on this list. I see a lot of guys they signed in those subsequent years for super cheap.
Right, yeah, like they pulled like the $200,000, $300,000 signings the next couple of years. But yeah, like your Diego Castillo's and Oswaldo Cabrera's and, you know, all those Dominican shortstops that they pulled, the lottery tickets, they don't look like they're going to hit on any of them. The next crop of guys after they got the penalties removed does include Everson Cabrera and Antonio Cabello, who are two top five prospects now, and they were both seven-figure guys in the 2017-18 period after they got the restrictions removed. And they also had a nice, they had a well-regarded 2018-2019 period, too, which was led by Kevin Alcantara, the outfielder. But, yeah, like the... I think they had the right idea with that. They just, you know, part of it's luck and part of it's they picked the wrong guys, and it happens sometimes. But going back a little bit further, like, you know, their big international signing from right before that period was Gary Sanchez. So they have had some success on the big dollar international signings. It's just those two classes in particular didn't work out for them. And, you know, they could have signed Yan Moncada and it would have worked out, but they didn't.
And yeah, that might not have worked out.
They could have at least traded him for Chris Sale. So.
I've had long fantasy dynasty debates about whether Yan Moncada is trash or not, and I'm on the trash side. But that's another podcast.
Sure.
So I want to go through the list kind of one by one real quick and skip over the two that everybody here has heard of, Jonathan Loaisiga, Estevan Floreal. Listeners, you've heard us talk about that before. And I want to come to the first name that I learned when I clicked on your list for the first time, and that is Antonio Cabello. He is an outfielder. He is was signed by the Yankees, as you said, for $1.35 million in 2017, and he's in rookie ball. Can you tell us about Antonio Cabello and why he's the number three Yankee prospect?
Essentially, we got really good reports out of the GCL on him, which is the Florida Complex League, which... Complex leagues, like, only barely resemble organized baseball. Like, the 40 games he played for the GCL Yankees were 40 of 150 games he played during this complex league season, but for weird reasons, those are the only ones that they decide to keep stats for. So when we say the stats mean nothing.
So can you be a little more specific here? Because if people who haven't seen these complexes, I don't think you think when you see these stat lines that these are, you know, real teams with stadiums and ticket booths and fans. Like, what's actually going on in these leagues?
So it's like a lot of them play in their spring training park, which is also many times the High A Florida State League park. and there is like some small number of attendance. Like, if you're in Tampa and you want to go to a GCL Yankees West game, you can, but like nobody goes to them. They're not played under like the tightest roster rules in the world, especially some of these clubs in the GCL and the DSL, which is the Dominican version of that, have multiple teams that they move guys back and forth from. The Yankees are actually one of them in the GCL. They have Yankees East and Yankees West, so they have two different teams in the same league. But it's like, these guys are playing from March when spring training starts until October when the instructional league ends, and they're functionally doing the same kind of thing, because like in extended spring training, they're still, you know, the Yankees team is still playing the Rays team at the same level, and they're still playing with umpires, and they're playing in a semi-organized manner. Now you can, in those kinds of games, you can do more bending on, like, you know, batting out of order and running like 12-man lineups and that kind of stuff, because they're not official games. But the difference in the quality of the competition that he's playing against in the strict GCL versus what he's playing against in instructs or extended spring is not particularly high. So when you're looking at the stat line for the GCL or the DSL, you're only looking at like a small slice of what it actually is. And it's pretty far from organized baseball. It's, if you saw it, you would think it was more like a college summer league or that kind of thing. Like, it's not like going to like the Lakewood Blue Claws or the Staten Island Yankees and seeing like a low level A ball team. That's just not what the complex leagues are for. These leagues are for learning. They're not really for competition, although they do keep standings for the GCL and they give out rings and that kind of stuff. So Cabello, basically, we got really good reports on his hit ability. People really think he's going to hit for average and hit for some power. He's also athletic. The defense is kind of tricky. He's a former catcher. They moved him to the outfield. He's not like a top 100 prospect, but he's a guy that would have been like the 100 to 150 range, probably the 120 to 150 range, because he didn't make any of our like next 10 product or anything like that. But he has the same grades as Loizagal and Florial. And he's kind of not entirely, he's like Florial like in the early part of 2017, like at that kind of level, when Florial was starting to pick up like a ton of buzz and hype, like right before he made his full season debut. That's kind of where Cabello and Pereira are both at right now.
One quick question about GCLs I thought of here. How do they get paid? Normally, a minor league club, they take in revenue, and they, for the most part, the club itself is paying the players. The GCL, it's different.
No, the club, the major league club pays minor league players.
Oh, really?
Minor league club. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So they're on a minor league contract, and the minor league contract usually, there's a standard contract that pays according to level when these guys are signed, and they're making, I don't know, in the GCL, probably like $1,000 a month or $1,200. They're making like sub-poverty wages, which isn't necessarily a problem for Cabello or Pereira because they got seven-figure contracts, but it's a major problem for the kid that signed for $10,000. And that's, you know, that's something we talk about a lot in the baseball community right now is minor league pay. So
yeah, we had on a podcast about a year ago, one of the lawyers representing minor league players trying to break some of the minimum wage issues. And I'll link that in the description for anybody who hasn't listened to it in a while. It's a great episode. We might have him on again soon, because I think there's been some interesting updates. But I want to move on to actual baseball. So Cabello, interesting high ceiling, kind of high hit tool outfielder. Next player is I think a really interesting sounding pitcher, Devi Garcia.
I think it's Devi, but I'm not 100% sure. I can ask the Trenton play-by-play John Moses at some point. He's going to be in Trenton this year. So
Garcia, 19 years old last year. He made it all the way up to, I think he had one game at Double A, spent, you know, between in the low minors, but still, you know, for a player his age, made it pretty far. Kind of a small guy, but he's the number four prospect here. It sounds like he's got some pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah, so it's like he's like a spin rate dude, if you've been following the spin rate discussions on the internet over the past couple of years. And spin rate in the minors gets weird because the teams have the information, but it's only selectively made public. There's no equivalent to Brooks Baseball or Baseball Savant for minor league spin rate or anything like that, or minor league velocities.
But there is the Yankees pitching coordinator Twitter page.
There sure is. Now, Danny Burrell is a clutch follow on Twitter. And the Yankees, I would say more than perhaps any other team in the league, certainly any other team that I deal with on a consistent basis, tend to be like really open with their information, which kind of starts at cash and goes all the way down the system.
Like cash bragging that Aaron Judge is hitting 118 mile an hour, you know, balls in Double A, or
yeah, like if you ask them, they'll just tell you. So somebody asked Danny Burrell on Twitter about Tevi Garcia's spin rate, and he confirmed that, you know, he throws a curveball at a spin rate that would be amongst the highest in the majors. Now, you don't need to know that to know that he like has a plus-plus curveball. That's something that people were talking about last year with him. He came into a little bit more velocity this year. He throws a really cool curveball. He's got, you know, advanced pitch ability, so he does like sequencing and command and that kind of stuff well. That's like code for when we like a guy and like how he pitches, but have no actual reason to say pitchability.
The dark matter of pitching.
Yeah. He's short. He's very skinny. Somebody in the comments mentioned he has a Pedro Martinez build, but for every pitcher that has a Pedro Martinez build that turns into Pedro Martinez, there's like 300 of them that never make it out of AAA.
Yeah, I've got a Nolan Ryan build, by the way.
Yeah, well, that's kind of, that's a weird one. People don't make cross-racial comps, like, ever.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you've read the Michael Lewis's book on psychology. The name of it is The Undoing Project. But he starts off telling the story of racial comps in basketball, and how as soon as one team decided to ban co-racial comps, so comparing a black prospect to a black NBA player, the accuracy of their predictions went up.
Yeah, I try to do that as little as possible. I don't like making comps in general, but I try, like when I do make them, if I can, I try to intentionally make them like weird, because it's no fun if you make that kind of comp. Like, you know, everybody gets, like if I'm going to comp anybody in baseball to Pedro Martinez, it's going to be Harold Gonzalez, a prospect of extremely minor note in the Mets system, and he's literally doing like a Pedro cosplay routine on the mound. Like he copied Pedro's mannerisms, he copied Pedro's Jerry curl, he wears number 45, he copied Pedro's pitching motion. He's not going to be Pedro, but if I'm going to throw a Pedro comp, that's what it's going to be on. Garcia's, so the issue here, and this has become an issue with evaluating a vast array of pitching prospects, is you got this short little dude, you know, kind of string bean. He's not that short, but he's, you know, he's extremely skinny, so he's kind of small. He's not particularly tall. He's maxed out at 74 innings over a full season. I have no idea whether this guy can hold up to a major league workload. I just don't. The Yankees probably don't either. So that's why there's risk involved. If you were looking purely on stuff, you know, he'd be a little bit higher on this list. I don't know how much higher. It's like really good stuff. It's not as good as stuff as Loaisiga, but it's not that far behind. And Loaisiga has basically the same concerns that Garcia does, mind you.
Not a huge guy.
Right. He also throws harder and has a similar quality breaking ball of different type, because Garcia's is more of like a two-plane classic curveball. And Loaisiga essentially throws a slurve. Some people call it a slider, some people call it a curve, but it's a slurve. That's not a bad thing, but it's like it's either a power curveball or a slower slider, depending on who you're talking to. But, you know, Garcia, so we don't know what kind of role this ends up being. And that's also okay, too, because teams have gotten a lot more open about what kind of usage they'll use pitchers in. You know, this idea of like multi-inning high leverage reliever is something that exists now. And the idea that you can still be a starting pitcher and maybe only throw 130 or 140 innings. Now, the Yankees are basically doing that with CC Sabathia, who's, you know, 19-year vet or whatever. So if they're going to do that with Sabathia, they're certainly going to be open to doing that with their younger guys, too. Garcia's probably going to be pretty good. He might be sneakily close to the majors, too. Like, this is a guy that could, if they needed to, make that jump and be in either the rotation or the bullpen at some point in 2019. I don't know that he will, you know, as a factual matter, because they have a lot of pitching depth. But once you have success in Double A, you can get called up at any time. That's what happened with Eliza in June. So
yeah, hopefully the Yankees don't need to call him up from Double A, but it's an option. Let's move on to talk about, I'm going to pronounce his last name incorrectly, Everson Pereira?
I think that's right.
Outfielder, slightly older than the other guys, I think. But we've heard about him a little bit before. It seems like he came out of Panama.
No, he's younger than Cabello.
Okay.
He's
been around.
He was born in 2001, if you want to be really scared. Yeah, he was also signed in 2017 signing pool. He was one of three guys, I believe, they spent seven figures on. And the third one is Rainfer Salinas, who's like barely a prospect a year later. So these things can go in all kinds of directions.
So why have I heard of him before? Is there actual hype around Pereira?
Yeah, he played at short season. So he was in the Appalachian League. So he was in a league that much more closely resembles real baseball. So like people were actually watching him play. That weren't scouts or media members or team members. He's younger than Wander Franco, who's like the wunderkind prospect in the Rays system, who everybody was remarking was so young for the Appalachian League. Pereira's actually younger than him. And he was fine in the Appalachian League. He wasn't great. It was like an empty 260. But if you're playing the entire season at 17 years old in a domestic A-ball league and you're like not absolutely horrible, that's like a real accomplishment. Not like super impact tools here, more projects. You know, Cabello we think has a better chance to like be a star level player. Pereira might have a better chance to be like your role 45, role 5, like third best or fourth best outfielder kind of guy. They both are young enough that it can go in a million different ways, but that's why he's kind of ranked a little bit behind Cabello, even though he's had success at a higher level. He's probably going to stick in center field if they want him to. Good defensive and speed profile. Has some projectability in the body, which is a nice way of saying he's skinny and might put on weight in the future and might, you know, get some muscle, nice swing, might add some loft in the future. You know, just kind of like your nice short season A outfield prospect.
A young kid like him who signs out of Panama, how much organized baseball is he playing at 14, 15, you know, 16 before he signs? Is it, like, what level of baseball is it? My impression is that it's a lot of kind of trainer leagues and not even equivalent to like U.S. high school baseball.
Yeah, and another thing that's happened is the guys at that level in international baseball, and this is especially true in the Dominican Republic, but it's also true in most of the other Latin American countries, they're locked up when they're 13 or 14 now. Like that, I don't know exactly when his bonus was agreed to, but I would be almost certain it was before his 15th birthday. So there's then this gap period, which can be anywhere from a year to 2.5 to 3 years, where they've already agreed to the contract, and their main goal is to not get hurt to get the contract rescinded, which happened to Christopher Torres, who was a Yankees prospect a few years ago that's got traded a few times and is with the Marlins now, I think. the development there can be kind of weird, and also, like, when these deals are made early, like, the players can get much better or much worse in between when they created the deal and when they actually sign. There was a prospect that signed with the Giants, Marco Luciano, who agreed to a bonus well ahead of time and improved a lot in the period in between when he agreed to the bonus and actually signed. And that can go both ways. Kevin Maitan went the other way, the prospect that was the major prospect that got declared a free agent in the Braves signing scandal and ended up with the Angels. You know, he was probably the best player in his age group in the world when he was 13 and 14, but by the time he was 16 and signed the first time, and certainly by the time he was 17 and signed the second time, he'd gotten kind of big and stiff, and the body had went in ways that you wouldn't have wanted, and he looks like he's going to be a straight bust now. It's a little early to say that, but he certainly hit it on that level. But, for the most part, these guys are like, you know, MLB has tried to step in and create, like, the Dominican Prospects League to give these guys, like, an organized outlet. But for the most part, they're, you know, in training with Buscones and less in any kind of, like, organized game atmosphere. The international market's just, like, it's very messy. It's very It's kind of difficult to talk about because you're talking about exploitation of young teenagers, basically.
Young teenagers from impoverished areas.
Often. Yeah. And who are getting waived enormous amounts of money at them and whose rights are often kind of just completely trampled on. This is a topic I feel very strongly about. But that also makes it kind of hard to, you know, it's hard to delineate, like, this is why we didn't write Kevin Alcantara. All I can tell you about Kevin Alcantara is, like, third-hand information based on, you know, I've talked to somebody who saw him 2 years ago. Like, it's that kind of information. You know, even when, for Cabello, you know, I did not see Cabello directly, but I talked to people that saw Cabello, and I did not see Pereira because I wasn't able to make a Happy League trip this year, but I talked to people that saw Pereira that I trust. Getting that information on guys that just signed out in Dominican or Panama or somewhere like that's just like impossible. So we're throwing darts in general, but that's extreme throwing darts.
And when a kid is 17 years old and playing in Pulaski, playing in a real baseball league, coming out of Panama, not even coming out of the DR, I mean, that to me, that it seems like that's got to be, you know, very, it seems like he's advanced. That's a good sign that he's advanced. And, you know, like you said, he didn't succeed really, but he didn't really embarrass himself there. And so that's kind of like the best case scenario, not the best case scenario, but like that's about as good as you could expect a player who's talented. And, you know,
something we don't talk about nearly enough is the cultural acclimation problems these guys have. There was a lot written about Wilmer Flores, who was formerly with the Mets, who was a top prospect out of Venezuela, signed for a seven-figure bonus, ended up becoming a decent MLB player. He just moved on to the Diamondbacks. But he almost quit baseball when he was in the Appalachian League. You know, do you know offhand where Pulaski is? I think it's somewhere in like West Virginia.
I have no idea.
Yeah. Like, you're dropping these kids into the middle of nowhere. Like, it's in Virginia proper, but it's in, like, the West Virginia part. It's in the Shenandoah Valley. You know, you're dropping a 17-year-old kid from Panama.
And I'm assuming there's no Crash Davis there to be like, right, hey, 17-year-old kid, you know, I'm going to show you the ropes. Like, they're all 17. They're all lost.
Right. Right, like, there's, like, you know, these guys have nutritional problems, they have language barrier problems, they have, you know, a lot of them get homesick. Jeffrey Paranasso, who's the lead prospect writer who I, you know, collaborate with a lot, do a podcast, we did a presentation at Sabre Seminar last year about, you know, some issues in player development. And one of the things we focused on, and we're planning on writing a series about this in the spring, is, like, just how little teams actually do to, like, support their prospects, which is, it's insane given the amount of money here. Like,
Do the Yankees do more?
The Yankees are better at this than most teams. They're still not great. Nobody's great. You know, nutrition is a big problem. Housing is a big problem. Cultural acclimation is a big problem. And I want to stipulate that baseball now is a million times better at this than they were 10 years ago, but they're still deeply lagging other sports, and they're deeply lagging where they should be. So when we say that him hitting an empty 260 in the Appy League is an accomplishment, it's also an accomplishment because he was dealing with all this other crap and also having to go play baseball at night, too.
I'm always amazed that players, that teams don't do like the really simple one, and I expect not that expensive things like build a dormitory. Right. Where you know, you have players, you know, moving, you know, between minor league parks and they're trying to find apartments and all these things. It wouldn't be that difficult for some team to do that. And I suspect it would pay off fairly quickly to do so. I assume that the reason they don't is what peer pressure from other teams.
The league, too. This is something that you're seeing this in all aspects of the collective bargaining. The league wants concessions from the Players Association to give out extra benefits, and this is something that would be considered an extra benefit.
All right, so let's move on to happier things and talk about, I think, the first player, in some ways I'm going to say, like, the first, like, it's not fair that the Yankees got this guy player, but then I'll remember that I kind of want Jake Cave back. Luis Gill. So the Yankees acquired him for Jake Cave right before Jake Cave was going to be Rule 5 eligible. So essentially they said, we're going to lose this guy anyway. We might as well
The other way around. He was on the 40-man roster, and they designated him for assignment in the spring because they had to add guys to the major league roster who actually made the team.
Oh, the Twins.
He got Rule 5 like 2 years ago to the Reds.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Was returned to them, ended up on the 40-man roster. They needed 40-man space this past March, designated firm assignment, and traded him for Gill. It's like a weird trend.
There's so many players like this in the Yankees that I get them all mixed up. The Yankees, there's a pretty good bullpen made up of just guys the Yankees gave away because they never roster spot for them.
They do it every year.
It's it's good. Cable prayer.
I like cable prayer. Yeah.
Luis Gill, tell me about him.
Yeah, so he's a dude they pulled out of the Dominican complex for the Twins, who, like, you know, had missed a season with Tommy John surgery. I think it was Tommy John surgery, might have been so, but he missed the 2017 season, and, you know, he had pitched a little bit. He hadn't pitched a ton. He's a tall kid. He throws pretty hard. It's an easy, pretty hard. His curveball's decent. His changeup's not there yet, but it kind of flashes occasionally. Command is kind of a theoretical concept, although not quite as theoretical as Luis Medina, who I constantly confuse him with because they're basically the same pitcher. But Gil's got more command. He's an easier motion. He's a long way away. Like, he's still 2 years away from figuring out whether he's 2 years away or not. I don't think I contradicted myself. Yeah, we had him as 2022, so that's not too contradictory. This is a guy that they're probably going to throw in Staten Island this year. Maybe he makes the Sally League if things go really well in spring training. Just kind of an arm, a good arm, a live arm, can go in lots of different directions. The Yankees have a lot of these dudes kicking around. He's kind of the first one that we ranked because it's a really free and easy, like 98.
But in reality, we shouldn't think too hard about the ordinal rankings here.
No, like, this is where it kind of starts. Ruanzi Contreras might be better than Luis Gill. Clark Schmidt might be better than Luis Gill. Trevor Stephan might be better than Luis Gill. Frank Carmon might be better than Luis Gill. This is where you start to get into. They have a lot of organizational stock in these types of arms. A couple of them will likely take jumps eventually. It could be any of them.
Yeah, let me skip over those next two so we can get to some shorter questions about some of these other guys. Clark Schmidt, does he still exist? And what should the Yankees expect of him next year?
Yeah, I mean, he showed up in Staten Island this year, so he still exists. So a little research project I did when the 101 list came out was pitchers that were kind of not even really in the mix for the 101 the previous year, who jumped to like the middle of the list the next year. And one class of pitchers that frequently does that is guys 2 seasons removed from Tommy John. and that describes Clark Schmidt, like, perfectly. Like, you know, he was pretty good before the surgery. He showed some flashes in his brief stints in 2018. Theoretically, now he's fully healthy, assuming everything comes back together. And Tommy John's a lot less of a sure bet than we like to talk about it. You know, it's a reasonably sure bet that the guy comes back, but sometimes they don't come all the way back in terms of velocity and command. But the early signs on him were pretty good. They took him really carefully in 2018. But they knew when they drafted him that he was going to, you know, he had already had the Tommy John surgery when they drafted him, I believe. He certainly, I don't exactly remember whether he had it right before the draft or right after, but they knew he had a torn UCL when they took him. And they still took him anyway, 16th overall, which says that they really like this guy. And, you know, it's like, this is a four-pitch righty, you know, mid-90s, heavy fastball, you know, very good slider. Again, we have absolutely no idea whether he can handle a pro workload or not. But there's a lot of nice pieces here. We just have to see him throw 120 innings on a mound somewhere.
All right, so Chance Adams, a name that many Yankee fans are familiar with. Let me tell you my impression of Chance Adams and tell me if I'm wrong. He had this big breakout season. He was really good in 2016, but I think the real big breakout season was his age 22 season, 2017. He's got this really nice-looking ERA. He gets all the way up to AAA. He was just bonkers in AA and then was, like, merely very, very good in AAA, at least by ERA. But the field-independent pitching numbers were never really there. You know, he had a not-so-great walk rate. He never really struck a lot of guys out in the high minors. You know, there was a lot of stuff, but people, it just wasn't showing up in the way you would expect it to show up. And then he kind of crashed and burned last year. And it felt like that was regression that was due, not something that changed about him. Is that the wrong reading of him? Or is he really potentially like a very good starting pitcher?
My belief, which is a little bit based on inside knowledge and a little bit based on having seen a lot of Chance Adams over the years, is that he was compromised by injury in 2018. And I don't know whether that led to a permanent degradation in his stuff, or a temporary degradation in his stuff. His velocity was not insubstantially down for most of the season, and his slider was not as sharp, and his command was not there, and we know he had elbow problems, and we know that the elbow problems were recurring in and out during the course of the season. The Chance Adams that threw in 2018 would not have ranked on this list anywhere. He's not a top 20 prospect if you go solely on his 2018. But this was a guy that was, before that, a top 101 prospect, and not like a low top 101 prospect. He was like a pretty reasonably high on the list. And he had success in the high minors. Again, not like superstellar success, but good success. And the stuff backed it up. You know, it was fastball, mid-90s, you know, touching 98 with, you know, relative frequency, you know, bordering on a plus-plus slider. The changeup is, you know, average-ish, maybe fringe average. So the thing about him is that he's a relief conversion. He was mostly a reliever in college. He was a reliever in his first pro season. He goes into the rotation, the stuff pops, and then he gets hurt. That would tend to indicate, and especially he's a fastball slider guy. The Yankees have a lot of rotational depth. I think he's probably going to end up back in the bullpen at this point. And I wouldn't be surprised if the stuff comes back when he ends up back in the bullpen. This could go either way this season. We'll probably know pretty early in the season. But I'm giving him at least a little bit of a pass because, you know, the stuff was still intermittently there. It wasn't there in the majors, but there were a couple AAA starts where there were some real nice reports on him. Intermittently.
All right, last long question, or I guess last normal question, might be very quick. Anthony Sigler, is there any hope for a switch pitching catcher in the major leagues?
So the history of prep catchers as draftees is so bad that we're like evaluating whether we should just like ding all of these guys substantially. I, you know, the Yankees were pretty vocal after the draft that he wasn't going to pitch, that they were just going to catch him, that he wasn't going to pitch, that he wasn't going to play the middle infield because these are all things he can do. It would be fun if they did. So the thing is, if you have a starting catcher, you would never actually want your starting catcher to do that. So if he's that kind of player, he's like more like Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, but also pitches, like, that means he's kind of, I don't want to say busted, but come in at like a 40th percentile. Or yeah,
he's not good enough to be a full-time starting catcher, but he's right. good he's enough like to be on a major league roster.
Right, he's like a 25th man, dude. Which when you take a prep bat in the first round, you're kind of hoping for more than that. So the answer is it's not impossible that he ends up as that, but if you're a Yankee fan, I wouldn't be rooting for it.
I think I'm rooting for it. Like, you know, we can spend money on someone better, you know, right. But we can't get a switch hitting, switch pitching catcher on the roster without Anthony Siegler.
He's pretty cool. He's pretty cool.
All right. Last kind of general question. So, what's the future of this Yankee farm system in terms of, like, I want to say strategy, but the big picture way that they think about this farm system? It seems to me like the Yankees are most comfortable kind of playing that mid-level prospect, like signing a guy out of college who's a power thrower for $100,000, or, you know, signing 20, $200,000 guys out of the DR. Is that the Yankees? Like, should we not expect them to go out and get the next Yoán Moncada or the next, you know, the big time player?
Well, the international free agent market is hard capped now, so they actually can do that now without spending an enormous amount of money. And because they're the Yankees, and, you know, 14-year-old kids in the Dominican Republic like know who the Yankees are, they do have some structural advantages in trying to woo that kind of player. Their draft strategy is toolsy up the middle guys and pitchers from major colleges, often in the Southeast and the Deep South, that like you've just never heard of, and then they all show up throwing 3 extra miles an hour and with a new pitch like 2 months later, which is, you know, and sometimes that, like, you know, Taylor Widener was that guy. Like, they pulled Taylor Widener out of the South Carolina bullpen. And I'm pretty good friends with Mike Bauman of The Ringer, who's a college baseball fan, but also a South Carolina fan. A
former political scientist, too.
Yes, he is. Michael's awesome. I love Michael. I actually just traded my, like, super deep score sheet league. I just traded for Orioles prospect Michael Bauman, pretty much just the troll Ringer Michael Bauman. Although Orioles prospect's pretty good too. But I saw Taylor Widener at the end of the 2017 season. He got called up to Trenton during the Eastern League playoffs, and we had gotten like some decent reports out of him in the Florida State League, but they weren't like, it was just like, yeah, he's kind of a good arm. So he comes in the Eastern League playoffs, and he's like mid to high 90s with like a wipeout breaking ball. And I'm just like, where did this come from? And he was just like some like random swingman dude they picked up out of the University of South Carolina in a double-digit round for $100,000. And then all of a sudden his velocity spiked, his breaking stuff spiked, and they traded him for Brandon Drury.
I guess the last little bit here, I mean, do other teams do that? Is that, like, I hear the stories about the Yankees doing this all the time, but is that just like, you know, the modern, you know, modern baseball player development machine, or is that just something the Yankees or maybe a few other teams have, like a superpower?
The Yankees are very good at scouting, and they are very good at pitcher development. They are very, very good at those two things. A lot of it is just organizational knowledge. You know, Brian Cashman has been the general manager of the Yankees for 23 years now, which is an incredibly long time in the baseball community. And before that, he was with the Yankees. And, you know, he kept around, you know, Stake Michael and a lot of those kinds of guys. For, you know, Nardi Contreras was around for years and years. Obviously, Stick's passed away and Nardi's moved on to other pursuits. But, like, you know, Danny Burrell's been around for a while. Like, they just do really good development, and they do really good scouting, and they also focus on specific things. You know, if you have an intense focus on college pitchers from the Southeast that were underutilized by your college programs. Like, if that's something you focus on and you or also know that you're good at developing those guys, by focusing on them, you can find them, whereas other teams, you know, maybe those guys slide below the radar. But the Yankees identify guys that they think they can coach up. They acquire them, then they coach them up, and then they often become bigger prospects. Sometimes they're then used in a second trade. You know, that's basically what happened with Jorge Guzman. And that's, you know, or and sometimes they become part of the major league team too, because, you know, their player development's really good. Like, and the Tulsi outfielders are the position player version of this, you know. For every, you know, you bring in Aaron Judge is a raw college hitter, and you develop him into Aaron Judge, you know, major league superstar, that's a big developmental win. That's, and they do that a lot. They just do. Gleyber Torres. You know, obviously Gleyber Torres was a very good prospect when they traded for him. But, you know, this guy's a major league star now, and he's a major league star specifically because he had a big power spike that was kind of hard to see coming when he was in the Cub system.
Jarrett, on that note, thank you for joining me. Is there any place that you'd like our listeners to find you online?
Yeah, my Twitter is at J.A. Seidler, S-E-I-D-L-E-R. I have a podcast on BP for all you kids out there, which is theoretically the BP. It's the old BP Mets podcast that's very occasionally about the Mets, is often about baseball prospects and professional wrestling and alcohol and other stuff. And I write at BP. The Yankees list went up last week. I believe the Astros list is next, and it's probably going up Friday. The 101 came out a couple of weeks ago. All of that product is still on there. And the BP annual should be, I think it just shipped. I think I got the shipping notice for mine today, which you can get at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, whatever. I co-wrote the Top 101 Prospects, and I also co-wrote the Astros chapter. So.
Jarrett, thanks for joining us, everybody. Thank you for listening. This has been your Bronx Beat Podcast.